This year, 2006, Chautauqua Institution celebrates its 133rd season. The Chautauqua Institution is a not-for-profit organization dedicated to lifelong learning. Based on the four pillars of art, education, religion, and recreation, Chautauqua's programs aim to renew the spirit, stimulate the mind, value the arts, and promote physical well-being. This audio experience is part of a program that shares the famous Chautauqua lectures, inspirational Sunday morning worship services, and other special events with remote audiences. We take you now to Chautauqua, where today's program is about to begin.
As you know, this week, indeed all week, we have benefited by the funding of Helen Boyle. Helen has given support to the Abrahamic Community Programming for six consecutive summers. Her devotion to this program is unbending and so important to us. We thank Helen and the members of the Boyle family for their support. Since 2004, we've had a partner in that funding in the Muslim Friends of Chautauqua. This is a group of individuals who believe in the work that we've been doing. They represent Ismailis, Sunnis, Shias, and Sufi Muslims alike. And one of the most generous individuals in that group is with us again today. And it's dangerous to point one person out of a group, but I do want to say a very personal word of thanks to Barkat Fazul for the loyalty and your generosity. And would you stand, please? This is Barkat Fazul. It is now my great pleasure to introduce you to Dr. Mahmoud Ibu, who serves as President of His Highness Prince Aga Khan Shia Imami Ismailis Council for the United States, Australia, and New Zealand. In this voluntary capacity, Dr. Ibu oversees the social and administrative governance of the Ismaili Muslim community in these countries under the guidance of His Highness the Aga Khan. He has been a member of the institutional leadership of the Ismaili community for the past 20 years. Dr. Ibu was a valuable participant in the Chautauqua Interfaith Conference in London last November, as well as a significant contributor to the Chautauqua Media and Religion Roundtable conversations with journalists held at the Harvard Club in New York City this past fall. Born in Kenya and educated in England, Dr. Ibu moved to the United States in 1983 and became a successful businessman in the area of laser technology. We are delighted to welcome him to Chautauqua. The title of this morning's lecture is Faith and Pluralism, an American Muslim's Perspective of Living in Plural America. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mahmoud Ibu.
President Becker, Reverend Joan Ron Campbell, distinguished guests, fellow Chautauquans, good morning. For those of you who had the opportunity to be at Professor Solomon Young's lecture yesterday afternoon, he made a reference to America being the graveyard of foreign languages and that Americans speak English only. I regret to tell you that America is also the graveyard of the English language. And you thought I couldn't be as humorous as Ray Suarez. A wise and learned religious elder. Louder. Up. I'm in the hands of your audio technician fellow at the back there. A wise and learned religious elder. Is that better? Perhaps a rabbi or a priest, an imam or a guru, was once asked by an exuberant and challenging student to respond to some deep queries he had about the nature of creation. What, asked the young man to this venerable old man, is the oldest of all things? And the wise, patient man said, the oldest of all things is God, because he has always existed. And the young man persevered and he said, tell me, old man, what is the most beautiful of all things? And the old man replied, the universe, because it is the work of God. And then the young man asked, "Tell me, old man, what is the most constant of all things?" And the old man replied, "Hope, because it remains with man long after he has lost everything else." And the young man thought he was on a roll here, so he kept going. And he said, "Tell me, old man, what is the best of all things?" And the wise man replied, "Virtue, because without it there is nothing good." And the young man asked, "What is the quickest of all things?" And the old man replied, "Thought, because it can in an instant fly from one end of the universe to the other." "And what," asked the young man, "is the strongest of all things?" And the wise man replied, "Necessity, because it allows man to face all dangers in life." And then he asked, "What is the greatest of all things?" And the wise man replied, "The human intellect, because it provides the capacity to understand all that God has created." And the young man paused and thought about this for a minute. And then he thought, "Let me go for one more question." And he asked the old man, "What is the easiest of all things?" And the wise, patient man looked at him and said, "To give advice." I am not sure whether I will be able to offer advice to this enlightened audience of Chautauquans, some of whom I've had the opportunity to meet in London at the Abrahamic Conference, which was held at the Ismaili Center, and who have become good friends. But as we reflect this week on the notion of belief in America, I thought I would speak to you today of my observations, my thoughts, my experiences, and concerns as an American, as an American Muslim, and a parent of two daughters who were born here, who are now 19 and 16, living at a time where there is great tension, confusion, ignorance, and hostility in the world. Much of it directed not just at the peoples of the Islamic world, but at the faith of Islam itself. For those of you who are not familiar with my religious tradition and didn't quite understand what Tom said, I am a Shia Imami Muslim. Our spiritual leader is His Highness the Aga Khan, the 49th hereditary Imam, deriving his descendancy from the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, through his son-in-law and cousin, Hazrat Ali, the first Imam. So I speak to you today not as a theologian, not as an institutional leader, or as an expert in Islam or comparative religions, but simply as an American Muslim whose ethnic origins derive from the Indian subcontinent, who was born on the African continent, who was educated on the European continent, and who has now lived for close to a quarter of a century on the American continent. It has been a journey of interesting encounters with peoples and places that ultimately shaped my worldview in which we live and the criticality of certain notions which I think are fundamental and which I will speak of shortly. It is perhaps important to set a context for my observations. While conscious of the fact that I was born a Muslim, my first encounter and engagement with religion was not with Islam, but with Christianity. As I began a new life in a British boarding school at the age of 6, I was immersed in Christian tradition, learning the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, reading passages of the Bible during morning services, singing hymns and psalms, and even taking an O-level exam in the subject of divinity, along with Latin, Greek, and French. At the age of 11, I knew more about Christianity than I did of my own faith of Islam. While not conscious of this at the time, what I learned about the world was through a colonial lens, a lens that subliminally said that Britain was great and right, and that Christianity had supremacy over all belief systems. I was reminded of this daily as I took out a coin of the realm that had inscribed on it Elizabeth R. D.E.F., Defender of the Faith, which was the absolute and immutable truth. But I was troubled by this preposition, the. this one small word, defender of the faith. And I asked myself the question, which faith was she the defender of? And was it her responsibility not to defend all the faiths over which she was sovereign? That thought was in the back of my mind for many years. My transition to public school at the age of 13 presented a second but broader encounter of significance. Britain, a country that had governed three quarters of the world's people for three or more centuries, slowly began to witness enormous migration from the colonies into this tiny island. The recognition that all these people of different color, creed, culture, and ethnicity were now British took some time to absorb. Here, in the hallowed halls of one of the most famous public schools in England, and I don't think by the design of our housemaster at the time, I was put in a room with three boys whose families, like my own, lived thousands of miles away. We discovered that each of us adhered to a different faith. Here, in this 150 square foot room, would live a Christian, a Jew, a Hindu, and a Muslim. At that young age, we carried little historical baggage or prejudices, but as students in such close proximity are bound to do, we were curious about our differences, and so we argued and debated, each championing our own faith as the right and true path to the divine. This was a debate that lasted several years, until we discovered, as we grew with time, that the essential truths in what we were arguing were the same. It was here in the proximity of that shared space that we learned to see, to understand, and respect each other based on who we were, irrespective of our religious beliefs. Indeed, we came to see no incompatibility, no incongruency in our different interpretation. And so my first discovery of consequence was that there could be plurality of religion and faith, and that there were many equally valid paths to the divine. Such encounters shaped and influenced how I saw and reacted to others, and particularly when I migrated to America almost 25 years ago. My Jeffersonian vision of America was a land of promise, of parity and equality, of principles, a country that espoused plurality and freedom, a country whose values and traditions resonated with my own, a land where religion could be practiced freely, where rights were respected, where opportunity and hard work were rewarded, and where the law protected all of the people. So much for a British education of the American colonies. But the reality of America turned out to be a little different. I observed a country that was full of strengths and openness, but also dichotomies. A land where there were shades of Christianity, ranging from the exclusive to the ecumenical. I also became aware of the range of Jewish denominations that also seemed theologically fragmented. Yet, within this theologically diverse tapestry, Islam, while known, seemed to be a foreign and alien religion that fell outside of most of America's consciousness. While this country was tolerant and accepting of my faith and my right to practice it, I discovered that there was a significant lack of understanding or knowledge of Islam, and certainly no notion of its historic and mutually enriching relationship to Christianity or Judaism as part of the monotheistic Abrahamic traditions. There was this respectful but arm's length inclusiveness, a sentiment that said, we accept that you believe what you believe, but we don't necessarily agree with it. The subtext said, we are really a Judeo-Christian society. And despite the fact that Islam is the fastest growing religion in the USA, we're not quite ready to acknowledge the idea of a Judeo-Christian Muslim society. While there is a general consciousness of Islam, it lacks the acceptance to qualify it as part of mainstream life. Muslim holidays are not nationally recognized or commemorated. We celebrate Christmas and Hanukkah and even Kwanzaa, but Eid does not feature in our cultural landscape. In other words, the notion of religious pluralism, the notion that goes beyond simple acceptance and tolerance to we recognize and value the religious truths you believe in to be common and consistent with our own, really does not exist. But the preoccupation at the time was with communism and its ultimate defeat. And with that accomplished, there seemed greater attention on the Muslim world. The horrific acts of terrorism on the morning of September 11th shifted America from tolerance and acceptance to animosity and suspicion. Almost overnight, America came to view 1.4 billion Muslims as a monolithic, unthinking, backward, and violent people that should be tolerated at best and eliminated at worst. I want to say here that Chautauqua and the Ismaili community lost a friend that day when Salman Danani, an Ismaili Muslim, perished in the collapse of World Trade Center 2. But to be clear, I personally was not just saddened, but outraged that such an indiscriminate act could be made in the name of Islam. It was not my first encounter with terrorism. The Britain of my youth was sadly not immune to violence and conflict either. I was close to the site of an IRA bomb that exploded in central London while I was at London University. The war in Northern Ireland, while pitting Protestant against Catholic for nearly a century, however, was not interpreted or viewed as a religious conflict, but a political one, a dispute over sovereignty. These were Irish terrorists, not Christian ones. No one saw these acts of terror as being representative of Christian philosophy, theology, or ethics. And I myself, living in that country, never understood these acts as being representative of the Christian faith. But a deeply wounded and hurt America could not seem to differentiate the tragedy of 9/11 as the politically motivated act of a minority of disenfranchised Muslims from the faith of Islam. Indeed, to many, this was Islam, a representation of its philosophy, theology, and ethics. It isn't. While it may not have been immediately obvious to most Americans, the vast majority of the Muslim world itself was stunned and saddened. One often hears the refrain, "Why don't more Muslims and their leaders speak out against extremism and violence?" The fact is they have. But how often has that been reported in the press? And how often, when it has been reported in the press, has it been heard? I suspect that the press, perhaps America, is seeking a single voice that represents the totality of the Muslim world to speak out. One leader. There isn't one. Because Islam is a multiplicity of traditions and interpretations that has governments, it has religious elders, it has imams. But there is, and there has been, a cacophony of voices. What we do know is that the values and ethics of our faith do not permit the violence that we have seen. As a Muslim, I firmly believe that the indiscriminate taking of life for any reason, let alone politically motivated ones, is wrong and contradicts the clear Quranic injunction that to take a life as is if to take the life of all humanity. With the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, we in America were exposed to an avalanche of new information about Islam that threatened to bury us. Some of this information, regrettably little, was good. But the vast majority was erroneous, shallow, sensation-seeking, fear-mongering. Images of Muslims celebrating the collapse of the World Trade Center turned out to be video of the liberation of Kuwait. Words from the Quran, such as jihad, have been hijacked and their meanings and contexts manipulated. The torrent of misinformation on Islam that poured into this vacuum of knowledge has filled people with misperceptions and misunderstandings that have become petrified as truth. Some Christian clergy espouse on their radio talk shows that, in quotes, Islam is a violent religion, the creation of a violent man who suffered from hallucinations. Documentaries being shown in theaters openly promote the idea that Islam is fundamentally violent, and all 1.4 billion Muslims are essentially evil human beings. One such documentary is titled Islam, What the West Needs to Know, a politically incorrect expose. This suggests that those who might be sympathetic to Muslims and Muslim beliefs do so only out of political correctness and not out of knowledge and understanding. Supposedly credible people add authority and legitimacy to these arguments, leading the audience to conclude that they must be suspicious of any encounter with a Muslim, and that Muslims must be avoided individually and communally at all costs. Some senior American generals speak of their military encounters in religious terms, turning this into a war between Islam and Christianity. The conflicts in the Middle East and those in Palestine and Kashmir have become to be viewed by the masses as religiously motivated conflicts, not political ones. An understanding of the historical forces that led to many of these conflicts after the end of the First World War and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire in 1918 is absolutely absent. Two civil servants, Mr. Sykes and Monsieur Picot, having afternoon tea, looking at maps in 1918, and arbitrarily drawing lines that would become the boundaries of Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Palestine, agreeing over cucumber sandwiches which imperial power should govern which territory. The vision might be comical, except that the Sykes-Picot agreement shaped the world we live in today. Slowly, like a deadly poison, Islamophobia began to creep into every facet of American life. Not aided by the media, with due respect to Ray Suarez, who have taken to labeling all terrorists as Islamic first, and then by their ethnicities as an afterthought, fear and apprehension about Islam has grown to extraordinary proportions. Conveniently forgotten is the Oklahoma City bombing and its perpetrator. Scholars propagate erroneous notions such as Islam in the West being an irreconcilable clash of civilizations that is doomed to a violent end. Perhaps we should ask the question, what do we mean by the West? There are 100 million Muslims that call Europe and America's their home. They live in the West. These Muslims are an integral part of the West, many in their third, fourth, and fifth generations. This notion of a clash of civilizations is a false construct. The real problem is not a clash of civilization, but a clash of ignorance. On both sides, there is ignorance from the West about the Islamic world, and I think ignorance on the Islamic world about the developments and the strength of the West. A 2006 survey showed 46% of all Americans, 46%, view Islam to be a violent religion. The building of a mosque or any other Muslim space of worship creates high anxiety in local communities. Chum for the sharks of the media who enter the debate with absolutely no knowledge of the subject about which they write. As I think about belief in America in 2006, I find that having come to this country and living in this country has become a contradiction of the values and principles that I thought the founding fathers of this nation believed to be sacrosanct, and my experience of that in my daily life. There is no question that the United States remains an overwhelmingly religious society. Recent polls indicate that 60% of the people consider religion to be very important, and that 85% identify with some religious faith. This includes the 6 million odd Muslims, many of whom who have lived here in the United States for 2 centuries. If this is so, then the notion of religious pluralism becomes critical for the future well-being and success of this country. As a parent, I was concerned how my children might be able to practice their faith in this challenging environment, whether their faith would be relevant to their everyday lives, whether it would be occasional, whether it would be comfortable to practice their beliefs freely, or whether it would define their actions, attitudes, and relationships with those they would encounter every day in their school classrooms, gyms, and playgrounds. To illustrate some of the challenges, my wife is a physical therapist, specializing in geriatric home health care. Treating an elderly lady after a hip replacement, this lady called her an angel for alleviating her pain and restoring her mobility. She accepted no other therapist and baked cakes for my wife to bring home. On one occasion, my wife mentioned that she could not treat her the next day because she would be attending a significant religious holiday. The lady asked, "Which holiday would that be?" And my wife replied, "The Muslim holiday, Eid." This lady simply said, "You do know you will go to hell." This extraordinary disconnect between the human experience and theological dogma is incomprehensible. It is difficult to understand how such a compartmentalization can occur when, on the one hand, a person can be described as an angel for their sensitivity and compassion, and on the other hand, a devil based on their religious belief. The foundational principle of freedom of religion seems to have developed some exclusivity. It's free for some, but not for others. It is ironic that 95% of Americans believe in a single deity. Yet, there isn't recognition that God, Allah, and Yeshiva are the same single deity. For those who may not be aware, God is even referred to as Allah by many Christian Arabs in the Middle East, and even as far away as Malta. How could this happen, I asked myself. More importantly, how could this happen in America? Ray Suarez, Rabbi Rudin have offered some thoughts. But I think my personal view is that it is because of ignorance. To paraphrase the documentary title, the question should be, what does the West know, and why don't they know it? Virtually nothing of consequence is either known about the faith of Islam or taught about it, despite the fact that Islam is the fastest growing religion in America. To most Americans, the totality of the Muslim world is Arab. The fact that the Arab world only accounts for 15% of the total population of the Muslim world is not apparent. America's knowledge of Islam's history, its cultures, its contributions to civilization, mathematics, art, medicine, literature, and governance are simply not known. Has the distance of time conveniently fogged the great accomplishments of Islam that led to the emergence of Europe from the Dark Ages into that period known as the Renaissance? As was the case with my own education in Britain, my first realization was the complete absence of Islam in the educational curriculum. As I looked through my social studies, my children's social studies curriculum, I realized how shallow and in some cases erroneous was the presentation of Islam. These curricula are not even written by Muslims for the most part. And when there is an attempt to educate, as one professor from the University of North Carolina discovered, when he recommended the Quran as part of his student summer reading, there was uproar. It is not surprising then that America knows so little. Within this volatile and sometimes hostile landscape, my daughter's Jewish and Christian friends were confused. This description of Islam did not resonate with the girls they knew as their friends, the girls they had grown up with, who had attended their bar mitzvahs, whose parents had entrusted them to our care and hospitality during sleepovers, and where they had spent hours immersed in the sagas of Barney, and eventually of Rachel, Phoebe, and Monica, whose clothes and shoes and cosmetics they shared. Were these friends innately violent just because they were Muslim? Could they have been harmed while sleeping in their friend's home? And it was here that I began to see hope, that most constant of virtues. For these young Americans saw beyond polemics and hate. Perhaps they never watched the news, preferring friends instead, and were therefore not influenced by the stereotypical images that streamed off the networks 24 hours a day. What they saw was a real person that they knew and loved, and they reached out to my children, as their parents did to me, and said, "We know you, we believe in you, and we will defend our relationship with you and your faith. You are not what we see on TV." And in reaching out, they asked me to educate them about the Islam I believed in and expressed through my actions and values and ethics. I was invited to their schools, a wonderful opportunity to correct the misperceptions and misunderstandings, to tackle the stereotypical images of Islam and Muslims. A Chautauqua mother arranged for her children's school to call me when they were studying world religion. I spoke to their class on a speakerphone in Phoenix, Arizona. It was a revelation for many that Judaism, Christianity, and Islam were part of the Abrahamic tradition of monotheism, that they were part of what the Quran, Islam's holy scripture, refers to as al-kitab, the people of the book. One book, one divine message from God to His prophet, delivered at different times and in different contexts. It was a revelation that the Quran has multiple references to Jesus and a whole chapter devoted to Mary, the mother of Christ. It was fascinating for them to discover Islam's contribution to mathematics, that al-jabra wa al-muqabala, the notion of restoration and balancing, is what they had studied in the previous period as al-jabra. You got it? At least we've educated some people today. That the first observatory was built in 9th century Baghdad, the same devastated city of today. That Muslim scientists invented the notions of azimuth, zenith, and nadir as astronomical concepts. That the first hospital was built in the 7th century by Harun Rashid, and that Ibn Sina's canon of medicine was printed 36 times, more than the Da Vinci Code, in the 15th and 16th centuries, and became the seminal text for medicine during the Renaissance. That the greatest mystical work in verse was Rumi's masterpiece, the Mathnawi. That the oldest university, founded over 1,000 years ago by the Fatimid ancestors of the Aga Khan, was Al-Azhar and not Cambridge. And the great wonders of the Taj Mahal and the Alhambra Palace in Granada were built by Muslim architects. I saw amongst these students and those that I talked to at other schools a glimmer of enlightenment, a genuine curiosity to learn and to discover and to relate. Thankfully, there are institutions and individuals, businesses and colleagues, and yes, even some others of my wife's patients who have demonstrated the courage of conviction, wisdom and belief to challenge this flawed thinking. Chautauqua is one such institution. Our very own Joan Brown Campbell responded to some of the polemics of other Christian ministers in the Atlanta area attempting to correct their misperceptions. Regrettably, she didn't succeed. Chautauqua's Abrahamic program is an example of this institution's efforts to educate and through that education effect transformation. And it has been our privilege to work with Chautauqua in building this awareness. Recently, His Highness the Aga Khan was awarded the Tolerance Prize by the Tutzing Evangelical Academy in Germany, whose mission is to increase awareness and respect between peoples and cultures through a discussion of political, cultural, and religious topics. More such initiatives from Christian and Jewish organizations are developing, and there are similar initiatives emerging in the Muslim world that seek to build bridges and not walls. I am reminded of Atticus Finch's counsel to his daughter Scout in Harper Lee's classic novel, To Kill a Mockingbird. When she is taken to task for engaging in a fight with a young boy from a completely different background, a background of which she has no comprehension. I'm afraid I cannot do a Gregory Peck impersonation. But in explaining how such encounters could be avoided, Atticus says, first of all, you really never understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb into his skin and walk around it. Sound advice. My children and their friends have walked in each other's skins. They have shared each other's beds and clothes, and through their experiences, they have come to know each other at the most basic human level. For them, there is no compartmentalization. They can see a good person irrespective of creed or color. As they educate themselves, thank you. As they educate themselves, I think they will discover that there is much that resonates between the Abrahamic faith traditions. And as I built lifelong relationships with my Christian, Jewish, and Hindu friends in my tiny schoolroom so many years ago, I believe the next generation of American children, those that will inherit the leadership of this great country, will also discover that there can be a plurality of interpretations, grounded by a common, universal set of ethics, and that those principles are what the founding fathers of this nation believed in 200 years ago. As a Muslim and as an American, I see no dissonance between the pluralism espoused in the Quran and that in the US Constitution. And so I might, after all, venture to offer some advice. We need to have the courage to educate ourselves and examine ourselves. Muslims, Jews, and Christians. If we are to live in a truly plural world, we need to transcend hatred and violence as a means of resolving differences and see how we can forgive. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks articulates the power of this notion in his book, The Dignity of Difference. He says, "Forgiveness is more than a technique of conflict resolution. It is a stunningly original strategy. In a world without forgiveness, evil begets evil. Harm generates harm, and there is no way short of exhaustion or forgetfulness of breaking the chain. It introduces into the logic of interpersonal encounter the unpredictability of grace. It represents a decision not to do what instinct and passion urges us to do. It answers hate with a refusal to hate, animosity with generosity. Forgiveness means that we are not destined endlessly to replay the grievances of yesterday. It is the ability to live with the past without being held captive by the past." His Highness the Aga Khan expanded on this notion when he received the Tutsing Award, when he said, "The human inclination to divisiveness is accompanied, I deeply believed, by a profound human impulse to bridge divisions. And often, the more secure we are in our own identities, the more effective we can be in reaching out to others. If our animosities are born out of fear, then confident generosity is born out of hope. One of the central lessons I have learned after half a century of working in the developing world is that the replacement of fear by hope is probably the single most powerful trampoline of progress. Even in the poorest and most isolated communities, we have found that decades, if not centuries, of angry conflict can be turned around by giving people reasons to work together toward a better future. In other words, by giving them reasons to hope. And when hope takes root, then a new level of tolerance is possible, though it may have been unknown for years and years and years. Tolerance which grows out of hope is more than a negative virtue, more than a convenient way to ease tensions or foster social stability, more than a sense of forbearance when the views of our other clash with our own. Instead, see not as a pallid religious compromise, but as a sacred religious imperative, tolerance can become a powerful positive force, one which allows all of us to expand our horizon and enrich our lives." From both, great advice. These are areas of concern that I have raised, and my hope is that with the assistance of open-minded and responsible individuals, we can find ways to work together to better understand each other. There are commonalities between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, not the least of which are our common values and ethics. Those ethics are few, 10 or 12, what God gave to Moses on Mount Sinai. Faith communities do not live in isolation anymore. Faith exists in concentric circles, and they often intersect, if not in doctrine, in ethics and values, and through history. The Holy Quran confirms that diversity was divinely ordained, and that while the same essential principles of faith were sent through prophets to many, if not all societies, differences in interpretation and practice were expected. Surah 49 of the Quran says, "O mankind, we have created you from a single pair, of a male and a female, and made you into nations and tribes that you may know one another. Verily, the most honored of you is in the sight of Allah, is he who is the most righteous of you." That, in my humble opinion, is the true definition of pluralism. One more piece of small advice. Give your children the gift of travel. Let them see the world with all its diversity, traditions, cultures, and religion. Our home is the planet. I worry that America has become too insular. Give them the gift of languages, English included, so that they may make the most of their encounters. It is my hope that my children and their Jewish, Hindu, and Christian friends will not be held captive by the past, that they will have the wisdom and courage to develop solutions for their generations to live in harmony and peace. Solutions based on dialogue and mutual understanding and mutual respect. Because I believe that it is our children who will be the agents of change to a better future. And so, our intrepid, curious young student, still sitting with our guru, has one last question to ask the wise man. And he looks at him and he says, "Old man, what is the most difficult of all things?" And the wise man patiently looks at him and says, "To follow advice." Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mahmud. That was really amazing and quite encouraging. For those of you who must leave right now, if you'll do so quietly, please, so those of us who stay behind for the question and answer can do so with a chance of understanding what's going on, we'd appreciate it. We'll start with a personal question, I guess. Are you still in contact with your mates from public school, and where do they live, and do they have experiences not unlike your own?
As a matter of fact, yes. The young Hindu boy that I shared a room with was my best man at my wedding, and I was his best man at his wedding. And one of the most trying things for a relationship is when you get into business together. And it just so happened that three of the four of us did get into business together, and we still survived.
Would you define and explain the word jihad as mentioned in the Quran?
The notion of jihad is essentially the notion of self-purification. It is the struggle that you undergo to purify and come to an understanding of self. In the references in the Quran, 90% of the references to the word jihad are used in the context of self-struggle. That's what it is contextually meant to mean. It is not meant to be, as it is now, as sort of a panacea for a holy war.
Can you help us understand the Quranic verses that promote violence against infidels?
Now, I did say to you that I was not a scholar or a theologian, but what I would respond would be this. As in my understanding personally, all religious scriptures, whether it be from the Torah, whether it be from the Bible, whether it be from the Quran, all have references of this type. I don't think it's anything that we can duck or push under the carpet. We could look at biblical texts and we'll see references to violence as well. My worry always is that when you single out and you say, is this exclusively something in the Quran? It is not. It is in all religious texts. My view also is that there is more in any of these religious texts and in all of these religious texts. And I'm sure the other theologians and scholars here will probably, you know, come and grab me afterwards and say, what did you say? You know, you don't have the expertise to say it. But I believe that there are more references to coming together of the people, of dialogue, of compassion, of justice, of equality, than there are on aspects of violence. And I think it is those things that we have to focus on.
We are awash in images of the conflict between Sunni and Shia Muslims. Can you help us understand, this questioner asked, the religious and democratic or governmental differences between them?
All right. This could be a long story or it could be a short story. I will try a short story. The difference between Shia and Sunni derives out of the notion of authority when the Prophet died. When the Prophet Muhammad died, the question of succession...
Just closer to the front line.
There we go. Is that better?
Yeah.
The conflict or the difference between the Shia and the Sunni interpretation is based on the notion of authority. It was based on who would succeed the Prophet Muhammad after he died. The Quran and various hadith that the Prophet had, sayings, referred to his son-in-law and cousin Ali as being his successor to interpret the Quran, the holy book. The notion being is that contextually over time, over centuries, it would need a guide to interpret the book in that context. When the Prophet died, there was a division of understanding. There were those that said, we accept Ali as the Prophet's successor and the first Imam. And they became known as the Shi'at al-Ali, the party of Ali, which is today abbreviated to Shia. Those that said, no, we have the Holy Book and we have the Prophet's sayings and deeds. That is all that is required for us to follow the path, the Sunnah, became known as Sunni. So it is two groups that have a difference of interpretation. One that adheres to the principle of there being an Imam, a guide from the Prophet's progeny to guide them, and those that said, we have what we have and that's enough. That fundamentally is the difference between Shia and Sunni. It is religious diversity of interpretation, much like you would have in the Christian world between Baptists and Methodists and Protestants and Catholics.
Can you comment on the practice of the issuance of fatwas by imams, and the most widely known is the one applied to Salman Rushdie? This questioner asks why there haven't been just a barrage of fatwas against terrorism, both in the United States and against fellow Muslims.
I have to tell you that the notion of fatwa is part of jurisprudence. It's a sort of a legal injunction, and I have absolutely no expertise in that area. So I would be, I think, on dangerous ground if I tried to attempt to answer a question on fatwas. And rather than misinform you and misguide you, I would ask Tom, maybe we could get on another opportunity one of the scholars to respond to that.
This questioner writes, one of the biggest concerns of the pastor at my Catholic church back home is what he calls retention of Catholics, especially the younger ones. What role?
Sorry, the retention of?
Retention of Catholics. So
yep,
the ability
yep,
to,
yep.
Especially the younger ones.
Yep.
So the question is, what role do you think this fear of loss plays in the willingness to embrace pluralism?
So say the end of it again.
What do you think that this, the fear of loss, that is the sort of melding into the larger pluralistic society, what do you think that, how that plays against the resistance to embrace pluralism?
I think there is no, in my mind, retaining one's cultural identity, retaining one's interpretation of a particular belief or a faith is not at all in contravention to living in a plural society. Because the way I see it, in my sort of simplistic way of looking at things, exclusivist psychology says, I'm right, you're wrong, I will go to heaven, you'll go to hell. It's exclusivist, very simple. Inclusivist says, you know, I accept what you believe, and I also believe what I believe, and I'm all right to sort of accept that you have a right to believe it. Pluralism goes one step further. It says, I actually believe that the ethical principles that you prescribe to are the same as my own. And you can have a different theological interpretation, but I understand and believe that the foundational ethical principles are the same. That means that I can live in a plural society and still be able to retain my identity and yet live and cohabit with others. That's the way I see it.
Could you comment on the effect that the Iranian revolution of 30 years ago has had on the world of Islam?
Now, I know Tom mentioned to me that there'd be some interesting questions. I would say that, you know, I go back to what I pointed to in my comments. Many of the issues of the world today are rooted in the post-collapse of the Ottoman Empire. And they tend to be born out of some form of inequity, injustice, where people do not have dignity and self-respect to be able to live their lives on an equal footing as someone else. I think there are, as I have mentioned, I think in the radio show this morning, there are always going to be, whether it's Christian, Jewish, or Muslim, groups of people who will wish to define, theologically in some cases, doctrinally in other cases, what people should think and how they wish to impose that on a particular viewpoint. That's not unique to Muslim governments, it's not unique to there are some that might argue, I think Rabbi Rudin, that there are shades of that in this country as well. I would say that in terms of the global politic, it is something that we have to today from the Muslim world come to understand, but not from a religious point of view. It is a political issue. It's not a religious issue. And that's, I think, what I always worry about is this misunderstanding that is there a move to have the faith of Islam take over the world and impose its religious philosophy. I don't adhere to that kind of thinking at all. Now, I'm not sure whether that got to the answer, but hopefully it'll help.
Actually, here's a message for your wife. Tell your wife not to worry about going to hell. I'm a liberal Christian, and my conservative neighbors said I'm going to hell too. The wife and I will have a lot to talk about. Which takes us to the question about women and Islam. Can you explain the Muslim view about equality of women?
You know, in the Quran and even experientially, there is again this misperception of Islamic women, Muslim women being second. So let me illustrate a couple of things. First of all, ask yourself, how many presidents of the United States have been women? But I can name prime ministers of Islamic countries that have been women. Even if you go back as far as the time of the Prophet, his confidant, best friend was his wife. And when he was receiving the revelations, the first person he went to say, what's happening, was his wife. In Islamic history, you will always find examples of Islamic women in leadership positions. Even in the United States, it was not that long ago. Not that long ago. And being a young student of American history, I think less than a century, that we had issues of rights of women here, in this country, which is a predominantly Christian country. So what I would say to you, the message that I want to get across is, it is not consistent with the view that Islam treats women. And there are certain ethnic, cultural, patriarchal societies that actually existed prior to Islam that always looked at women as second-class citizens or what have you. These are cultural dimensions. These are not representations of the faith of Islam.
In addition to the Quran, what other texts would you recommend we use to educate our high school students? Beyond that, what books would you recommend for self-study on the topic? And then finally, back to the text, what can be done about changing and improving textbooks?
I think there has to be, in the educational system, a way in which the curriculum looks at civilization, not Islam theologically. We're not talking about the theological dimension of Islam, but in world history, world civilizations, the treatment of Islam needs to be different. And I think there has to be work done, and I know there is work being done in various areas to re-look at the treatment of Islam in the textbooks. Insofar as I do think that's critical, by the way, because I think it's our children who need to be educated for the future. Insofar as reference materials, I would be happy to have to give Tom some reference materials that he could put on the website for you, and that we can tell you where and how to get access to. There are some very, very good books that are quite readable, and some that are just totally unreadable. But I will make sure that it's the sort of, I wouldn't say simple stuff, but it is material that that is not so scholarly and dense that it would put you to sleep in 3 minutes.
Are there U.S. news sources that you would suggest that provide accurate and insightful information about Islam?
Do you really want me to answer that? I'm not impressed, to be honest with you. And actually, I have talked to Ray Suarez yesterday, and we've talked before to his office about opportunities to see if his network would be willing to look at things differently. And he was quite open-minded about it, actually. So there are those who are willing to make the change. And as he said, he's always under attack, but I think he has the courage of conviction to do the right thing. So I think there is movement, but it's not good at the moment.
This person says in my reading, that is the person sending this, of the Quran, I see lots of emphasis on intellect, reason, and walking the straight path, but few references to actions in response to God's love. Can you comment?
Well, you know, someone asked me this not long ago, and I did talk to someone at the Institute of Ismaili Studies about this. Part of the challenge about this notion of love, every day, every Quranic ayat starts with the phrase, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And it depends on how you choose to translate it from the Arabic. It could be translated as, in the name of God, the most loving, the most merciful. In the Arabic context, the language uses the word compassionate, all-inclusive, of those dimensions of love. It has a broader meaning to it. So every ayat opens with that particular articulation. There is no disconsonance in my mind that that reflection of love is totally reflected in the Quran. I think this notion of intellect is very powerful in Islam. It is very powerful within our own interpretation of Islam, the Shia Ismaili interpretation. For us, God's greatest gift to mankind was the human intellect. And it is the human intellect that allows man to be able to discourse, to be able to see God's creation. And that's why there is such a focus on it. But the Quran, I think, to a certain extent, even with other biblical texts, will have, I think, more of a, in my mind, more of a roadmap, a philosophical underpinning to it, a more of a ethical way in which you do things. And then it leaves man to actually do it. And that's what we're here to do.
Are your daughter's peers more aware and accepting of a plural and diverse religious culture than older generations?
I think they're getting there. I don't think this notion of plurality really was conscious before 9/11, to be honest with you. I think it's after that, that this idea that, you know, we have Muslims, we have Hindus, we have more than one kind of Muslim. There are even different kinds of Muslims, not one big block who are all the same, really began to crystallize in their minds. And so I've had many chats with their parents, with them themselves, when they've been curious. They've seen, you know, certain textbooks that I have at home. And I think that curiosity is now building. And as I mentioned, I don't know if is Kate Lincoln here somewhere? She might be, or she might be. Kate Lincoln was the one who asked me to talk to her school. And I found, honestly, that there was, even within the school system, a greater curiosity to understand this notion of pluralism.
Many Americans fear the Islamic concept of Sharia, given the context in which it's often discussed. Would you please comment?
It's one of those other technical questions that requires a lawyer to respond to be honest with you. Let me leave it at that before I get myself into trouble or you into trouble on matters of the Sharia.
There are, I must say, several questions about the conflict in the Middle East, and all of them in varying ways of expression are basically asking you how Muslims, non-Arab Muslims, view that conflict and how you feel about how that conflict goes about identifying or communicating who Muslims are.
Well, I think that's a two-part question. My sense is that when I travel to Europe, which I do fairly frequently, and you read what is in the European newspapers, you see what is on European news channels, it's very different to what you see here. And what comes across in Europe right now is an anger, is a sort of a feeling of anger, perhaps, that is developing, of the scale of how things have escalated. And I think we have to be very mindful of this. We have to watch this carefully, because anger is one letter away from danger. And I think there has to be something that the leaders of this country and other countries need to do to de-escalate the situation. I think the second thing is this notion of Israel and Hezbollah. And there is therefore a connotation, again, that there is an association with a war between Islam and Israel. That is wrong. It is not a war between Islam and Israel. It is a war or a conflict between groups of people who, for whatever political reasons, are at odds with each other. And I think we have to always keep that at the back of our minds. This is not a conflict of faith. It is a conflict of politics.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mahmoud Ibou.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
For more information on the Chautauqua Institution, including a catalog of our full audio program, please visit our website at www.ciweb.org or call 1-800-836-2787 or write to Chautauqua Institution, Box 28, Chautauqua, New York, 14722.